hello, friends and neighbors. Thank you for tuning in. We'd like to start today's show with a question. What was the first museum you went to? Or, if you prefer, what's the weirdest exhibit you have ever seen in a museum?
Are you asking me? Or is this for the, are we polling the audience?
This is for everyone.
Do we have to wait for the results to come in?
We'll have to wait for you all listening.
Okay.
But I'd like to hear from you now. I'm Ben. You're Noel.
Oh, thank you, Ben. Thank you for introducing me. I appreciate it. This is the first. That's a first.
Is that a first?
It's a first.
I feel like we're getting more organic with our intros.
It's almost like we're getting a little familiar. It's like we've done a few of these.
Mm-hmm. It's like we're becoming veterans. Which, funny story, did you notice that in the initial promos for this show, we're referred to as veteran podcasters?
Veteran podcasters?
Mm-hmm.
That means we've been to podcast war?
That's true. We came out changed. But the only way we got through that, and the only way we get through this show, of course, is with our super producer, Casey Pegram. That part of the intro we're always going to keep.
Yeah, and I'll never get tired of it.
Mm-mm.
And I mean that with my whole entire heart. Speaking of whole entire hearts, I will answer real quick your question.
Yeah.
I recently went to a museum that was by far the most bizarre and amazing display of stuff I'd ever experienced. A place called the Museum of Death in Los Angeles. There's also one in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And it has everything from preserved human hearts, you know, in glass jars to fetuses. There's a whole section on embalming and funereal kind of relics from, you know, the way they used to do things back in olden times.
Mm-hmm.
Spoiler alert, wasn't pretty. And an array of grisly crime scene photos, the likes of which I've never seen anywhere in my entire life. Just the stuff of nightmares.
Follow-up question?
Yes.
Do they have a gift shop?
Oh, big time. I bought a coffee mug, and one of the things they also had in this museum was a whole room devoted to taxidermy, in particular a section with beloved pets that had been taxidermized.
Taxidermied?
Taxidermied? That seems better. That seems more right.
Taxed?
Boom.
If you want to be cool.
What about you, Ben?
Thanks for asking, man. Yeah, I love museums. It's no secret. Anybody who interacts in the world of social media and finds me on there will typically see that whenever I travel to a new city, the first thing I want to do is find a museum. And we are very fortunate, you and Casey and I all together, because the United States is chock full of fantastic museums.
Just lousy with them.
Just lousy, rife with them. There should be a museum about museums. Is that too meta?
That's way too meta. You would immediately get swallowed up into some kind of time-space wormhole.
So what would the gift shop sell? Would they sell gift shops?
I can't even, Ben.
Noel is shaking his head here. The Carnegie Museum of Natural History is the setting for our episode today, or at least our starting point. And have you been to the Carnegie Museum?
I have not. I am shamefully under-museumed. I've been to a handful of cool art museums, but not very many natural history museums. I've been to the one in New York.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to the Met, obviously. There's a natural history museum here in Atlanta.
Yes.
Fernbank. That I have never been to. Spoiler alert, we might take a trip there one day for a little extra credit.
Yes. Behind the scenes, I have been cajoling Casey and Noel to come check out Fernbank. I have nothing but good things to say about it.
Do they have a mammoth?
They do not, as far as I know now.
I'm not going.
Okay. Well, I will text you pictures.
I'll go.
Great, great. They also have an IMAX theater.
I don't want to experience FOMO.
Right. Especially at a museum.
I know. Museum FOMO is the worst.
Mm-hmm. So the Carnegie Museum of Natural History has a wealth of exhibits. And this is a storied, prestigious institution. One of their exhibits is called Lion Attacking a Dromedary.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. I've seen, they call them dioramas,
mm-hmm.
which I think is interesting. Because when I think of a diorama, I think of the thing you'd make out of a shoebox and cut out little, you know, the baby Jesus or something. But no, this is a diorama in that it's posed, taxidermied creatures
mm-hmm.
in very dramatic throes of action, right? This one is no exception. It is a dromedary, a camel, and a lion that is just like, I mean, it's really quite remarkable. There's a dead female lion on the ground inexplicably. You don't really understand what happened. Did the dromedary gnaw it to death?
Stomp it, more likely.
Stomp it, I guess. Yeah, I guess they've got some stomping power. But the lion is just on it, just set upon this dromedary that is, you know, just in these throes of agony, its head, you know, rearing back, its teeth exposed, and it just looks really pained. And then on top of this dromedary is a rider, right, Ben?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So this is a snapshot. It's as though you're viewing a 3D photograph, a tableau. We're entering in media res, in the middle of the story, and there is a rider here, a man who is riding the camel, being attacked by this lion, possibly an act of vengeance on the male lion's part, because you'll notice when you pull up the photograph, the man is holding a knife in his right hand as he leans away from the attacking male lion. And just to get this out of the way, we know that taxidermy can seem a little controversial or even creepy to some people.
A little bit.
And that's understandable. We know that the animals in this are taxidermy. They were once living, and now they have been transformed into these sculptures. But there was a strange, gruesome twist that people discovered after this diorama was made, and it's the following. It turns out the rider in this diorama is not entirely artificial.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the implication here is that, okay, the lion's taxidermy, the lionesses, the dromedary is, but the guy on top is, you know, presumed to be a mannequin of some sort. Mostly, yeah, that's true, except when you take a good look at this guy's face, very expertly rendered, might I add, by French taxidermist and naturalist Edouard Verreaux in the mid-1800s. Very, very amazing attention to detail on this guy's face. But when you look at the teeth, there's something about it that's a little off, or maybe a little too on.
Yeah, I like the phrase, a little too on. The teeth give it away. And in the early 1990s, conservation records indicated that the conservators of the museum and of the piece said, wait a second, I know my mannequin teeth, and these teeth are too real.
Yeah, there's an amazing photograph of it up close on a National Geographic article called 150-Year-Old Diorama Surprises Scientists with Human Remains. Because yes, the basis for this mannequin head was in fact a human skull of undetermined or at least quite difficult to determine origins. And they found this out after doing a CT scan of the thing. Mm-hmm. So basically, the skull was the basis. Everything was molded around the skull to get that shape. Mm-hmm. And then the teeth were laid bare. You know, like those are the teeth. And it, you know, if you look at this close up, you can really tell.
Yes, you can really tell because the face itself, which has been constructed, as you mentioned, from the skull. The face obviously builds on anatomical patterns, muscles. The eyes are clearly fake, right? You get that it's supposed to be a person, but you don't think it's a corpse until you see the teeth, which are weathered, they're stained, there are some gaps in there, they're ground flat in some places. And now that we have the benefit of knowing what we're getting into, it clearly sticks out, but we have to wonder, were we strolling through the Carnegie Museum, if we would have noticed this, would we be the kind of people who stop and say, whoa, those teeth are too real? I doubt it. It took an expert.
And like you mentioned earlier, Ben, it wasn't until the early 90s that conservation records showed that some of the folks involved in, you know, preserving these artifacts did suspect that the teeth were in fact real. Just the teeth. But it wasn't until just a couple years ago in 2016 when it was taken off exhibit to be, you know, cleaned up and restored and also researched, they discovered that it was in fact a human skull and not just human teeth. So there's a really, really problematic story that led up to this discovery. And it all starts with a family, the Verreaux family.
Mm-hmm.
A storied taxidermy family. That's
yes.
A thing.
Yeah, that's a real thing. And they formed a family group. You know what, Noel? I think it's time for Casey on the Case.
Guys, I mean, I appreciate being called in for these French pronunciations, but you really could have worked this one out yourself. It's just the Maison Verreau.
Oh, okay.
And that concludes our episode of Casey on the Case.
I would have said the Maison Verreaux.
We are very lucky that Casey is here.
I know. If only he were an Englishman and could tell us how to pronounce Catesby.
Catesby.
Could have saved me an embarrassing email.
So you have to wonder also whether the researchers felt embarrassed when they discovered this. You mentioned the CT scan, and now we're diving into the history here. So, Noel, tell us a little bit more about this strange family.
Yeah, we've made fools of ourselves asking Casey to pronounce Maison Verreau, so I'm going to go ahead and just go out on a limb and really try my damnedest with these French names. Casey,
you can do it.
If you feel the need to chime in and school me, go right ahead. You can call your own Casey on the Case segment. It can be Casey on Noel's Case. But the Verreau family, the Verreau clan, was made up of Jules, Jean-Baptiste Edouard, and Alexis Verreau, and they were all... How'd I do, Casey?
I'll allow it.
Okay, Casey didn't have to get on Noel's case, so we're good there. Yeah, but they were all the sons of this really well-renowned Parisian taxidermist by the name of Jacques-Philippe Verreau, who founded that House of Verreau, the Maison Verreau taxidermy company. And it was a big deal.
Yeah, established in 1803, this is the earliest known company that dealt in objects of natural history, and they funded collection expeditions across the globe. So they would send agents and send, you know, members of the Verreau family out to places that most of Western Europe was unfamiliar with to collect specimens.
Yeah, and that's going to get really creepy really quick. So trigger warning, if you don't like the idea of taxidermied humans, this is probably not the episode for you.
This does also involve quite a lot of institutionalized racism.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a trigger warning for that, too. So
let's set the stage. As we said, they're traveling around the globe. In 1830, while traveling in what we now today know as Botswana, Jules Verreau witnessed the burial of a warrior.
Yeah, he was about 27 years old, presumably, when he died. I wasn't able to find a cause of death, but he did die around 1830. And the Verreau brothers attended his burial. And you might say to yourself, oh, that's nice. You know, they're participating in the culture that they're trying to capitalize on.
But wait.
Yeah.
Because what happened later that night?
They stole the body.
Mm-hmm.
They grave dug.
Yeah, they functioned as resurrection men.
Yeah, which is such a... That was actually a trivia question last night where we play trivia. Mm-hmm. Resurrection men. The question was actually, what is the less pleasant name for the old-timey practice of resurrection men that would be frowned upon today? Because resurrection men implies that you're... It's like a profession. You're like doing a service of some kind. You're...
Right. It sounds a lot better than grave robber.
Or professional defiler.
Yes, yes. So when Jules sneaks in to the burial site, he steals the skin, the skull, and several bones. He intended to ship this body back to France. He prepared and preserved it using the tricks of his trade, his craft, and he augmented it with metal wire, wooden boards, and he also stuffed it.
Yeah, there's a really grisly quote from this fantastic New York Times article called Africa Rejoices as a Wandering Soul Finds Rest. That's sort of a prelude to a happy ending that we'll talk about in a little bit. But apparently, according to a guide, a taxidermy guide published in the 1830s, in order to properly preserve a dead human, quote, it is necessary to make a circular incision around the fingertips and peel back the skin as if it were a glove.
Right.
Mm.
And that is a genuine thing.
Yeah.
This is a very nuts and bolts, step-by-step process. Mm-hmm. And so they bring this corpse, the stolen corpse, back to France, to Paris specifically. And they also bring a lot of other stuff with them.
Like a metric crap ton of specimens, from some estimates in the neighborhood of, you know, several thousand individual creatures.
Right, right. Mostly animals.
Oh, yeah.
Except for this, this one stolen body. And when they brought it back, they didn't immediately showcase this. This was just included in their package. And actually, as we found, they left it in their shop for a while. Isn't that correct?
That is absolutely correct, Ben. They had it propped up as some kind of macabre display, it fitted with feathers and, you know, made out to be this sort of example of this native, kind of like a weird trophy or something. Mm-hmm. It's really pretty vile.
Right. And there was a lot of othering that was very common in scientific circles of the day. So to them, taking and preserving the corpse of a human being was essentially no different from taking and preserving the corpse of an exotic animal. The weird thing about this is that it was pretty common, almost a status symbol at the time, to have taxidermied animals.
Of course. You've seen, like, the hunting lodges of the rich and powerful with, you know, just dozens of zebra heads and elephant heads and all this kind of... I mean, I'm not going to, like, ding anybody's hobby or whatever, but there does come a point where it feels a little gross to me personally.
And inhuman?
A little bit. You know, I'm all about hunting for meat and feeding your family and using every part of the animal and all that stuff. But when you see pictures of these CEOs, you know, holding up elephant tusks, giving the thumbs up, that, all right, now I'm grandstanding. All right, let me get off my soapbox. But they were celebrated, these Varro brothers, right? The climate in France when they returned was one of jubilation. They were welcomed back with open arms. In fact, there was a report in La Constitutionnelle from November 15th of 1831 that described their return in glowing detail, calling them young compatriots of France and, you know, just really a lot of patriotic fervor surrounding their return. And the La Constitutionnelle article described their most, shall we say, rare specimen as such. And this is, hang on to your hats, folks. But their greatest curiosity is an individual of the nation of Bejuanas. This man, preserved by the means by which naturalists prepare their specimens and reconstitute their form and, so to speak, their inert life. He is of small stature, black of skin, his head covered by short, woolly, and curly hair, armed with arrows and a lance, clothes in antelope skin, with a bag made of bush pig, full of small glass beads, seeds, and of small bones.
So, with great acclaim, the Varro outfit returns to Paris. They display this body in their shop, and eventually, someone says, you know what? I like this so much that I'm going to buy it. And that was a Spanish nationalist named Francesc Darder. And we don't have the exact amount that he paid for this, but we do know, we do have a pretty solid timeline of what happened afterwards, because this naturalist said, you know what, I'm not going to take this and just set it up in my living room. I'm going to take it to the global stage.
Mm-hmm.
And that is how this poor, unfortunate soul ended up being displayed at the 1888 Barcelona World Exhibition. Or should I say Barcelona?
You should. Ibiza?
Yes, yes. We were making some jokes, but this is very, very troubling stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's all I can do to just not be completely bummed out by this. But again, there is a happy ending.
Wait for it.
We're getting there.
It's on the way. So Darder didn't just buy this one corpse. He had an extensive natural history collection. And when he passed away, his collection was sent to a museum.
That's right. It was the Museum of Natural History in Banyoles, Spain.
So it was on display from 1916 at this museum to 1997 when a controversy finally arose.
Yeah, I mean, one that had been brewing for some time. I don't know if we mentioned this, but I read somewhere that they actually painted the skin of this person a darker shade of black.
Right. Yeah, that is unfortunately absolutely true.
And it kind of became this sign of, you know, there's a history of Spanish people exploiting and enslaving Africans.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Western Europe overall.
Of course. But I'm just saying, like, this was a problematic thing on many levels, on a humanitarian level, but also on a ideological level and what it represented. And it just was not a good look. And yet this museum constantly fought back against giving up this individual's remains to its home country for a proper burial.
Yeah, there's an excellent article on the BBC that traces this titled "The Man Stuffed and Displayed Like a Wild Animal." And in this, they detail how after, as Noel said, incredibly strong resistance from the museum, this body was finally returned. And this didn't happen until, what was it, October 5th, 2000 or so?
Wild.
And when this warrior was returned, they were to lay in state for a day in the capital, and 10,000 people visited to pay their last respects. Interesting side note here, Noel, it was a Christian burial.
Really? I didn't catch that. Tell me more.
So the priest who was conducting this said, in the spirit of Jesus Christ, who also suffered, you know, we're going to lay this man to rest, finally. And the foreign minister at the time said, quote, "We are prepared to forgive, but we must not forget the crimes of the past so that we don't repeat them."
That is interesting. How do you feel about that, though, it being a Christian burial, given the background and given the brutal nature of this uprooting of this person's remains, and then to ultimately have their burial be something completely unrelated to what they likely believed in life?
Yeah, we have to ask ourselves these questions. You know, was that in part a political play by the government of the time? Was that a true, sincere effort? And, you know, if it was a true and sincere and genuine effort to pay respects, then I'm all for it, although it is riddled with problems. And here's what happened, though. So you may have thought that we already got to the good ending, the light at the end of the tunnel.
Oh, I thought we had. You got a twist? You got a Shyamalan twist?
There's a little bit.
Shyamalan twist?
There's a little bit.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. There's a little bit of an Act 3 twist here. After the burial and after laying in state, the grave was neglected for several years, and the field that was around it was being used as a football pitch.
I'm sorry, come again?
As people were playing football.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Football pitch. And the Botswanan government later, thankfully, went back and restored the site and enhanced it. They built a visitor center and explanatory signs. As of now, it is still not known what this man's name was, exactly where he came from, or what his life was like.
Yeah, and to get back to what started the story with the diorama of the dromedary, right, in the Carnegie Museum.
The diorama drama?
Yeah, this all comes back to something that you mentioned, Ben, an interesting angle, which is museum ethics. There are still struggles between the governments of the places of origin of many artifacts and the museums that hold them in their collections. And it's not cut and dry. It's not always like a matter of just saying, hey, that we should have that in our country. Mm-hmm. And instead, you know, Mr. Carnegie or whatever, you know.
Sure.
But with the remains, that is probably a little more cut and dry. And, you know, the museum would certainly have been willing to return that skull if they knew where to send it. But that's the rub, right?
Right. That's the problem. That's the heart of the matter. Or should we say the skull of the matter? Other than knowing that this diorama was built by Edward Verreaux in the mid-1800s, we don't know the origin of this skull. We don't know who it came from. We don't know where they lived. We know very, very little about them.
I would tell you one thing we do know is those Verreaux were not cool.
Oh, creepy. Creepy.
Have you seen the movie Taxidermia, Ben?
I have not. Should I check it out?
I think you should. It's really, it's quite disturbing. Have you seen it, Casey?
Yeah, it's like a Hungarian movie.
It's a Hungarian movie. There's one character who shoots flames out of his penis and different, you know, odd characters over time. It traces the lineage of this family. And one of them becomes a taxidermist. And I'm going to spoiler alert real quick. See it. This isn't really really matter. It's more of just a tableau. The guy builds a machine that allows him to taxidermy himself.
Oh, finally.
Yeah.
This is fiction, right?
It is very,
just
very,
to
very
much.
Just
want to establish this for you folks.
What gave it away? Was it the flames out of them?
I don't know, man. It's a wild and fascinating world in which we live.
So check out Taxidermia if you want to, you know, if this got wet your appetite for creepy things. Mm-hmm. It's worth a look.
It's worth a look. And most importantly, this controversy continues today in museums across the planet. We're going to wrap it up. We hope you enjoy. Oh, so close, Noel.
It's time, gentlemen.
What time is it?
For the Quizster, of course. The mischievous, mirthful man that is the Quizster.
Oh, my goodness.
You were in high spirits today.
I've won so many times, I do not freaking know what to
do
with myself.
Yes, Quizster.
So this is the segment where our longstanding nemesis of the show, the Quizster, Jonathan Strickland, comes to test our knowledge of real versus fake history.
Are they the same person, Jonathan Strickland and the Quizster? Is it sort of a Superman Clark Kent?
It's a Venn diagram that has a lot of overlap.
I gotcha. Okay.
Yes.
Good to know. Good to know who to hate.
That's just, well, Noel, it's clear. You've been sending me little messages on our messaging system the entire day,
yeah,
threatening
my life. You like those?
And it was very clear that I need to maybe ease off a bit. That's the message I've been getting.
Hey now.
This is news to me. What are you doing, man?
I just told him.
He just said things like, hey, you've got a nice podcast over there. It sure would be a shame if someone, I don't know, set fire to it.
Something like that. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Noel, are you okay?
Yeah, I'm just really fed up with this Quizster segment, but people seem to like it, so I guess we have to keep doing it forever now.
For those who do not know what the heck is happening, I will explain. So I come on the show, and as Ben alluded to earlier, I present a scenario. The gentlemen here have 3 minutes to determine whether or not said scenario represents an actual historical fact or if I made it up, sees. I also create an arbitrary rule that you have to follow if you wish to ask any questions of yours truly, the Quizster. In this case, because we're talking about dead people, your rule is going to be a little tricksy. Before you can ask a question, you must quote at least some portion of the wonderful, wonderful song Dead Man's Party by Oingo Boingo.
Who could ask for more?
There you go. Perfect. Danny Elfman vehicle, Oingo Boingo.
Can I quote the horn part?
Absolutely you can. Absolutely. Yeah, we could do the whole thing. You know what?
Yeah.
That's it. We're just throwing the segment out. We're just going to jam, guys.
No. We've already set it up. We might as well get it over with.
So lay it on us. And also, I'm noticing that your accents are a bit more dynamic today. You have a lot of pep.
I drink like 10 5-hour energy drinks because I got a lot of stuff coming up.
You're 50 hours deep?
That's right.
All right.
I can see next week, man.
Well, let's hope we can see through your deception, right, Noel?
Oh, man, I hope so.
Here's your scenario. You will start the timer when I give you the signal, which will be start the timer. Here it is.
Good, good.
Italian artist Giovanni Balducci in the early 17th century got a peculiar commission. He was hired to paint the portraits of the upper crust of Naples. But these were very special portraits, for they were missing one important feature: the subject's heads. See, he was painting these portraits in the catacombs of San Guadioso, where the decapitated heads of deceased hoity-toities were placed in alcoves in the walls. Balducci painted frescoes of rich people in their finery around these heads, which I must stress still had flesh on them. Oh, and he did it for free because he considered it an honor. Start the timer.
Don't run away, it's only me.
Yes, Mr. Bullen.
Okay, so is this still on display? Like, could people still go see it?
For a long time, it was not on display, but in 2006, some people who were trying to attract more visitors to this particular part of Naples got together and commissioned an entire fundraising event, and now it is, in fact, open for you to tour.
So, Ben, do you picture this as being sort of like those catacombs in Prague, or like the ossuary? You know, it's like a church made of bones, stuff like that. Obviously, there's no more flesh. That's the part that throws
That's
me.
That's sticking with
that
me,
That throws
too.
Me, man.
Because flesh decompose, unless it's treated and preserved, flesh will decompose or desiccate at some point.
I feel it only necessary to say that when I said still had flesh upon them, I meant at the time he was painting the frescoes.
Yeah, I know, but that's gross. That's going to smell. That's not going to be fun. Painting around decomposing heads.
It was a different time, Noel. People were used to different smells.
I don't know. I'm all bugaboo.
You could go either way?
Yeah.
Do you have a question?
Not really. I don't want to speak to this man.
All right. I'm all dressed up with nowhere to go.
Yes, Mr. Bolin.
So 2006, you said, is when this went back on display.
Mm-hmm.
Has this artist done any other work that we would be familiar with?
Not recently. He's been dead for 400 years.
Right, man. Come on, man.
Yes, he's done other works. He was a student of Vasari. Vasari being a 16th century Italian artist, mostly known for his biographies of other Italian artists, but he has done other works. Most of them would be considered uninspired, you might say.
Don't be afraid.
Yes, Noel.
I just wanted to do it. I don't really have anything for you.
That's fair.
All right, well.
I'm going to say false.
I am feeling true. You want a Rochambeau?
Yes.
Okay,
ready?
Ready
to go.
One, two, three, shoot. Oh, now I want to go with yours.
Okay.
Yep.
So Noel wins, but he made the decision to go with Ben's decision, which was the opposite of his. What was your decision again, Ben?
We're locking it in.
Yes.
Yes?
True.
You have locked in. Right. Well, son of a gun, I knew
it. Yes!
Show me that smile again.
So this
that was
I'm pretty sure
I leapt
you
from my seat and did a dance.
Pretty sure you spiked the mic on that one, buddy. All right, so yes, in fact, this is true. The catacombs were closed to the public until 2006. These days, there are not even skulls in those alcoves. They have crumbled to dust. Now they're just frescoes with around a hole, essentially, where the head would be.
Mm-hmm.
But at one point, there were the actual recently deceased heads of these rich people, including people who were described as princesses. In those walls. It is under the Basilica of Santa Maria della Sanita. If you are ever in Naples, that is the one you go to. And there are about 20 frescoes in total.
So he painted these frescoes for free, surrounded by rotting, decapitated heads, because it was an honor.
Yes. He thought because this was supposed to be a celebration of a person. The head was supposed to be the center of that person's being, and that he was there to glorify that. That it was such a great honor. He refused the fee that the church tried to pay him in return for his work. He said, no, I do this for them. And so he refused payment.
Just like you're out here doing this segment.
And I don't get paid for it.
You're doing God's work, Jonathan.
You're paid at Schadenfreude and spite.
Came up short this one.
Well, you know what, man? We can't win them all.
I mean, you
Except
literally
today.
You literally won.
Today.
You literally won Rochambeau and you went with the other
choice.
I
know, because it was my gut. I may have won the Rochambeau, but my gut said Ben was right.
And you're getting a lot better at rock, paper, scissors.
I know.
I want to establish that.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. So not fair.
Oh, man, I'm starting to like this segment again.
This has been an emotional roller coaster on many counts. Quister, thank you, I am required to say, for coming on to the show.
I'm pretty sure I'm still ahead by one.
You know, what's a couple numbers between friends? So I have a feeling that Jonathan and Noel are a bit more competitive than I am. So please, guys.
I really did leap out of my seat and do a hammer dance.
I mean, that really is absolutely true.
Yeah. Nice. But we may have won the battle. We have not won the war.
The war still rages.
The war still rages. And something tells me that something probably being super producer Casey Pegram, that this is not the last we've seen of the Quister.
Yeah, I'm cool with that. I've got my dignity back now. How about you, Ben? You never really lost it. You weren't as invested in this as I was, I don't think.
I'm invested, but it's just because I find so many things fascinating. I look at it as a learning experience.
Oh, excuse me, guys. That's my chauffeur. He says there's room for maybe just one more.
Well played. And on that note, we'd like to thank Jonathan Strickland. We'd like to thank Casey Pegram. We'd like to thank Alex Williams, who composed this track. And most importantly,
we'd like to thank you, Ben.
Oh, no. Thank you, Noel.
You're welcome, man.
The pleasure was mine.
It's shared. It's mutual pleasure.
All right. Well, before this bromance goes off the rails,
I'm really uncomfortable.
Well, it's too bad, man. You chose to sit in the middle.
That's true.
So we're going to head out. Tune in next time when we explore the strange story of a flying aircraft carrier.
It's sort of a sequel, kind of. Mm-hmm. Sort of Zeppelin 2, the Zeppelining.
Electric Zeppelu.
I love it. And, you know, Ben, you're quite fond of airships, so I know you're happy about this one.
Oh, I am thrilled, my friend. Why, you might ask? You'll have to tune in and find out. In the meantime, you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter.
How's your vision board coming, dude?
It's going really well.
Yeah.
I had a moment where I just decided to take off the Christopher Walken pictures.
I have a whole section on mine that's nothing but Christopher Walken pictures, but with Steve Buscemi's eyes.
I know, you keep texting me.
But hey, if you don't want to do any of that stuff, you can just write us an email directly. We're ridiculous@howstuffworks.com. And thanks to you. I already thanked Ben, did the bait and switch there. But thanks to you folks for tuning in and joining us for another episode of Ridiculous History. We'll see you next time.